Hi, Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. All this week on WCAI, we're looking at ways researchers are trying to stop Alzheimer's disease. This disease, which steals memories and changes personalities, is one we've reported on before. Past radio series have gone into great detail about how the research is funded, and we've completed a series about the burden on caregivers and the resources available to help. This time, an anonymous group gave us a grant to do some travel, to get on a plane and go to the places where some of the top Alzheimer's research is ongoing. Our senior reporter and editor Sean Corcoran joins us to talk about his Alzheimer's disease reporting and the hope for new therapies, treatments, or even a cure. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Mindy.
And joining us a little later in the show from Harvard Mass General, Dr. Ruta Tanzi, one of the world's leading Alzheimer's researchers. That might be a good time to ask any questions about the disease and the ongoing research surrounding it. But first, Sean, you've done a lot of reporting about Alzheimer's over the last few years. Tell us a little bit about how you became interested in this particular topic and what led to this series.
Well, I do have some family members with Alzheimer's. I think most of us do. Most of us have seen it. And if you haven't, you will, because of the sheer numbers that are heading our way of people with this disease. But that really wasn't what got me interested in reporting on it. A few years ago, I got a call from a Martha's Vineyard resident, Jeffrey Morby, and he started to tell me Actually, it was an interesting conversation because he said to me a question. He said, "Do you know how much money the federal government invests in Alzheimer's disease research?" And he made me answer. I had no idea, right. But I think I said maybe $5 billion a year. And he said it was $500 million a year, $500 million a year, right around that. And, you know, I know that's not a big number.
Yeah, when you compare like cancer research and some of the other research, they get a lot more money.
Yeah. Oh, billions, yeah. Billions. But it's also, you know, you look at, they built a high school in California for $300 million.
Right.
And then you see these numbers float across the newspaper each day about, you know, what they're putting billions of dollars in the federal government, the decisions they're making. So that's, you know, was a
striking,
big number,
yeah.
Very striking. And he started talking, Jeff Morby started talking about this group that it was pretty young at the time, the Cure Alzheimer's Fund. And it was a group of pretty successful families who had gotten together and decided, you know what, we want to try to cure Alzheimer's. We want to try to find the doctors who are doing the research that could lead to a disease. And they had a plan to find, I mean, lead to a cure or preventative. And they had a plan to find that cure or preventative. And they were going to pay for everything. Cure Alzheimer's Fund families were just going to pay for all the overhead. It was a nonprofit. They weren't interested in getting money if they found a drug or anything like that. And it was just pure altruism. So mm-hmm. I ended up doing a series about the funding and about Cure Alzheimer's Fund. And that was maybe 2008. Mm-hmm. And then a few years later, I, you know, was on the ground with caregivers and a five-part series about that. And it was just a very different experience because you're with these people as they're trying to take care of their loved ones who often just run away mm-hmm. and aren't the same people they used to be or fell in love with or grew up with or whatever it happens to be. So with our population, yeah. I know that this is of interest to people who listen to our station. And also you just read so much stuff in the newspaper mm-hmm. about what can prevent it, what can stop it, this food, this exercise.
Right. Drink hot cocoa, all the stuff that you think, well, that doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. So I said, I'd love to be able to get to those doctors. And luckily, Boston is one of the hubs. So there's a lot of great researchers in Boston. But I wanted to get to the other researchers around the country. And so we were fortunate enough to get this anonymous grant.
Yeah.
And so off I went.
Off you went. That's right. And you're right. I think when we look at the lack of money that the federal government is spending on the research in this area, it's really surprising when you look at the numbers and what's expected to happen. I mean, the numbers are only going to increase. I mean, this is a huge problem we face.
Right, right.
As I think some people said, could bankrupt the
They say it's a fact. Yeah. If we do not put the disease off in some way, delay it in some way, at the very least, you know, so you don't get it, you're not half the people at age 85 perhaps don't get it. Maybe it's only 30% or they get it later. You know, you have to put this off because just the numbers are going to overwhelm not only Medicare and Medicaid, but private insurance companies. Yeah. They say it's a fact.
Right. So in this latest series, Desperate for a Cure, you visited lots of labs around the country. So where did you go first?
Well, I went back to Cure Alzheimer's Fund first and said, look, this is what I'm going to do. who do you think I should go and speak with? They have an advisory board of Nobel Prize winners and top scientists who identify where the best research is going on and say, this is worth funding, this isn't. So that's kind of where I started. Where do you think I should go? And I went and talked to Rudy Tanzi, who's going to join us later, about some of the hubs mm-hmm. of Alzheimer's research, and Tim Armour, who also works for Cure Alzheimer's Fund, is the CEO, and we identified different places like UCSD in San Diego and Pittsburgh and New York City hospitals in these locations, St. Louis, Washington University in St. Louis, and Boston, of course. So I went first out to San Diego, meeting Dr. Steve Wagner out there, but I also went over to the Salk Institute of Biological Studies that, you know, everyone knows Jonas Salk. Mm-hmm. He developed the
polio vaccine.
And I met a doctor there who is in a very small lab that Dr. Salk used to use. And he is, you know, one of the older folks in the field. And he kind of laid out the history of Alzheimer's research for me a little bit and gave me some perspective on some of the debates within the field itself, which was fascinating, which was great to know as I went on and talked to some of these other researchers. I got a bite from Dr. David Schubert from Salk.
Sort of the evolution of the whole story is that, you know, Alzheimer's in 1910 defined the disease more or less, and this was the first association of pathology and the brain associated with behavior, and so this was sort of that's what the disease is named after. But then for the next 50 or 60 years after that, people, it moved away from that idea. The people thought that it was mostly a German, you know, pathologist who dominated the field at that time, thought that this was something uniquely associated with aging. And it really didn't redefine itself as a disease until the 70s and early 80s.
So they started to find genes related to Alzheimer's disease, particularly early onset Alzheimer's disease, which strikes, it's a genetic, mm-hmm. It's passed on through your genes, and it strikes early. Sometimes 40s, in your 30s, 40s, almost always before your age 60. Mm. And so once they started to identify these genes, they started to see where the pathway was, how the disease worked a little bit better, and started to be able to come up with some drugs.
Yeah. Now, in today's installment of the series, you report from the University of California, San Diego, where researchers are making molecules to attack the disease, and they want to do that early, right? Even before symptoms.
Right. Now, this is a major theme that stretches throughout the series, because this is what the researchers are talking about. You know, they've tried to intervene, and they'll continue to try to get in there and see if they can clear out plaques that are already there. But the idea really that many researchers are behind, and the NIH, the federal government, is behind, is preventing it. Mm-hmm. Just like you might take a pill to prevent the buildup of bad cholesterol in your blood. So that's what they're thinking. They need to get a drug into people early before the symptoms show up. They know that amyloid, which is one of two major proteins that they know is involved in Alzheimer's, this beta amyloid or amyloid beta, whatever you mm-hmm. want to call it, or A beta, it builds up in the brain over time, and then it comes together and forms the telltale plaques in the brain. So they think if they can administer a drug early, stop a particularly bad form mm-hmm. of beta amyloid from forming and not affecting the good beta amyloid, then maybe the plaques will never form. And then maybe other things that they know happen in the disease won't happen. So I met with Dr. Steve Wagner out there at UCSD. He's creating some Alzheimer's drugs. They're a little bit different than previous versions of drugs that have been tested in people unsuccessfully. And he was extremely gracious, so many researchers to talk to, and one thing that Dr. Wagner talked about, he talked about the importance of having not just a good drug, but good diagnostics, good scans mm-hmm. to be able to see what's happening in people's brains, to see what type of symptoms pathology is going on, what you can see going on there. And so they want good scans. And let's hear him talk about that.
What we're learning is that if you come in and you start doing these types of clinical trials with patients that are already showing pretty significant signs of dementia, there's a good possibility that that we're not going to be able to have an impact. So it's my belief that having something that is reliable and very diagnostically accurate and very sensitive, that really helps the drug discovery process, because then we can do what I believe are the most likely clinical trials to have an impact and to be able to demonstrate effects on the disease course. So it's like anything else. You always want to get something early with cancer, with diabetes, with cardiovascular disease. You can't come in there when things are so far gone.
You know, Mindy, this doctor, Dr. Steve Wagner, was in a lot of the promos for the series, mm-hmm. and he's the guy that's saying, it is panic time.
Right.
And you could, just the passion from these doctors mm-hmm. was unbelievable. They see that the America's way of life is on the line mm-hmm. if we don't cure yeah. this disease.
One thing that I heard you say, which I found really interesting, is just in that, going back to the diagnostic mm-hmm. tools we have now, it used to be you had to die from Alzheimer's before we could say for sure that's what you had. They had to test it in the brain. But now we have tools to get that diagnosis
right.
earlier than we obviously could in the past.
Right. They do tests in the clinic. You know, certain type of psychological tests and cognitive testing. And then they can pretty much confirm their diagnosis now with the scans that they have, the brain scans. They've developed dyes that will light up the mm-hmm. pathology of Alzheimer's disease, whether it's the tangles and most recently the tau tangles, and as well as the amyloid beta plaques. They've been able to do the plaques for a little while now, but the tau tangles are new. So significant advancement. And it, you know, when you're testing a drug, you want to be able to see if it's working. And they can give people spinal taps and look at the spinal fluid and see what's going on there with amyloid and, you know, some of these biomarkers. But if you're in a drug study for a year and a half, 2 years, whatever it happens to be, you probably don't want to go get a spinal tap, once a month or
right.
whatever it's called for.
So you say in this last 13 years or so, about 100 Alzheimer's drugs have failed. So what's different now?
Well, they say they've learned a lot. This is the third wave of drugs, and they're not just turning down this beta amyloid, which is one of the first things they see accumulating in the disease, you know, as early as 15, maybe even more, 20 years before the first symptoms appear. So they say that now they know a better amyloid, the specific amyloid to kind of go for. And so they're not just trying to clear as much of it out as they can. And, you know, as we've been saying, the problem is to test these drugs takes a long time. There's some frustration in the field. There's frustration among pharmaceutical companies because mm-hmm. things haven't worked. But it's expensive. But Dr. David Holtzman kind of put it into perspective a little bit. He's from Washington University in St. Louis. And he says to get to the disease early really is crucial.
It takes a long time to go from being asymptomatic to becoming symptomatic. Often, even if you have a predisposition or are developing Alzheimer's disease in the brain but are still normal, on average it might take anywhere from 3 to 6 years to convert from that state to becoming impaired. So the trials that you would need to do a true prevention or secondary prevention trial are going to be very expensive and long. And so it's been very difficult to convince, let's say, a pharmaceutical company to do a trial like that that's not going to cost a few $100 million, it might cost more. And so there's many advances we're going to need to make as a society to figure out how to do, in my view, how to do those kind of trials, because that's probably what's going to be needed to really, in my view, make a major impact with therapy.
You know, one of the things that researchers all kind of talked about is funding.
Yeah.
And, you know, actually, when I'm still putting the finishing touches on Friday's story.
Not completely complete.
it's just the finishing touches, yeah. Of course. But one of the things I want to do is kind of put all their quotes
about
funding
yeah.
together, just because that's when these researchers, they're not all science talky at
right.
that point. They're real people.
Right.
And to have them all linked together would be nice. We'll put that on the website probably sometime next week. But they all talk about funding. You know, we heard from Dr. David Schubert, the Salk Institute researcher. I mean, this guy took years and years to come up with a compound that he says can slow the disease, improve the symptoms. He's got postdocs working there when he can find them. He's kind of cobbled together grants of $10,000 here, $20,000 there. He has been the recipient of NIH funding. So, I mean, he's a recognized guy in the field. But the likelihood is that this compound he's come up with, J147 as he calls it, will probably never be tested in humans because who's going to step up and pay for that?
Yeah.
And we're going to play a few bites in a moment about this, but what the stories do not address is what happens to Alzheimer's research funding now that Congress has decided to shut down the government.
Right.
You know, we can ask Dr. Rudy Tanzi about this later in the show, but already this year, because of sequestration, spending on Alzheimer's research was reduced by 5% just off the top.
And they're not getting that much to begin with. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, other countries are increasing their investment, which seems to make sense. And now we have the U.S. government shutdown. Who knows how long that will last? Probably not too long. But you have to wonder, will the politics of Washington now prevent people like Dr. Sperling at Brigham and Women's in Boston from starting her highly anticipated drug studies? She's getting the folks together now to test this drug in. And it's one of these long tests, a preventative type test. So I think the funding issue is a big one. And one of the folks I talked to is Dr. Neil Buchholz. Now, he is from the NIH. He's the director of the Division of Neuroscience at NIH. And he talked about funding cuts and labs closing and people going overseas.
And in fact, it's interesting that between 2012, fiscal 2012 and 2013, while other countries have increased their funding for scientific research and development. For example, China increased their funding by 15%, Germany, Japan, and South Korea by 5%. The U.S., basically, because of sequestration, reduced their funding by 5%. So it's very discouraging overall for science and technology funding, which is really a major driver of the U.S. economy.
We are talking with our senior reporter and editor, Sean Corcoran, about his series airing all this week, Desperate for a Cure, the Search for New Alzheimer's Treatments. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And about 5 minutes or so, Dr. Rudy Tanzi is going to join us, one of the world's leading Alzheimer's researchers, and I'm sure you'll have some questions for him. Sean, you mentioned this protein tau a few minutes ago. What's the debate on that?
Yeah, this was interesting to me. There's two proteins that they know are definitely involved in the disease, and they're learning a lot more about both of them. And the first one we've talked about is this beta amyloid or amyloid beta or A beta, whatever you want to call it, which builds up and kind of gloms together and forms these plaques in the brain. But there's also later in the disease tangles, and this tau, this protein tau, very important to our cells. It kind of breaks down and forms these tangles in the brain. So once they started to learn about the genes related to beta amyloid, the research field tended to move in that direction. But some folks were like, well, what about tau? What about other aspects of the disease? And this has gone on 20 years or so, more than that. And they call the beta amyloid people the Baptists and the tau people the Taoists. And they battle, I guess. But and people told me about that and I read about it a lot. And, it's kind of a sexy thing for the journalist to kind of go for a Baptist Taoist. Yeah. Not so much anymore from what I saw. Almost every lab I went to, except for the real, real tiny ones, they were doing stuff with tau or with other types of potential interventions or treatments. So, yes, a lot has gone on. Most of the direction has been with beta amyloid, but tau is now being studied more and more. So it's not so much this schism. I think it's changing. But let's talk Sam Gandy. He's a big-time researcher down at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. He talked about tau.
You know, where we have these genetic clues where mutations in amyloid can either cause a disease or prevent the disease, And I just think it's irresponsible not to exhaust the amyloid story before we completely abandon it and turn to something else. The other reason is that everything else is moving very slowly. Drugs aimed at tangles, drugs aimed at other targets. They're much less well validated, and we don't have a lot of them. It's not like if we stopped the amyloid research, there would suddenly be 50 tau drugs to give people. There are a couple not especially promising tau drugs that are being tested, and that's it. So there's going to be a big, if we just sort of say, okay, that's it, amyloid's over, there's going to be nothing in trials for decades.
I'm eager to hear from Dr. Rudy Tanzi. He's going to be joining us real
Couple
soon.
Minutes, yeah.
He can answer all your questions much better than I can. But
you've learned a lot, though.
I have learned a lot.
Able to answer my questions.
I'm dreaming about peptides and amino acids. It's insane. But Dr. Gandy also spoke about where we are now in the research for new drugs.
The truth is, we don't know when we'll have a cure until we have a cure. I mean, science just isn't predictable. It isn't linear. But the public will see that as hopeless if we sort of try and give that message. And so everyone tries to, we're continuously asked how long until there's a cure. And everyone says 5 years, except I say it might be 20 or more, but which no one wants to hear. Most people say five is sort of the longest palatable time. People think, okay, I can make it for five more years, then there'll be a drug. But the truth is that no one really knows. Where are we now? We have a few drugs that will move the neuropsychological tests, but nothing that has so far had any impact on meaningful clinical function. The hope is that this sort of hint of a signal on the neuropsychological tests, if we then move that back, take those drugs earlier and earlier, that will be then equivalent to stopping the disease. That little hint of activity, if you go early on, will be enough to stop the disease before it gets out of control. But that's logical and it's testable, but we don't have the answer yet. And we've been wrong before.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about Alzheimer's research with WCAI senior reporter and editor Sean Corcoran, who just completed a series about Alzheimer's research. The series Desperate for a Cure, The Search for New Alzheimer's Therapies, airs all this week during morning edition at 7:30 a.m. and again at 4:50 p.m. during All Things Considered. And joining us on the phone from his lab in Charlestown now is Dr. Rudy Tanzi, the Joseph and Rose Kennedy Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School and the Director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at Massachusetts General Hospital. Good morning, Dr. Tanzi.
Good morning.
So one of the things Sean's reported on was this disagreement in the field of Alzheimer's, where some researchers say too much time has been spent studying a certain protein in the brain, as we've been calling that A-beta, amyloid beta. And some researchers say it's time to move on to other areas and not be so focused on this one protein that is known to form the plaques in the brains of people with Alzheimer's. So Sean's reporting shows that most labs are expanding their interests. What are the other proteins that are being explored, and what's your sense of all of this?
It's a continuum, so you need to think about the pathway that this disease takes in terms of the pathology in the brain. Genetics tells us, the genes that we and others have found over the last 20, 30 years, guarantee that beta amyloid initiates the disease. All the established genes affect how much amyloid beta protein you accumulate in your brain. But the amyloid then has to trigger tangles in the nerve cells. And it's those tangles made of tau that kill the nerve cells. And we would argue, based on looking at brains of deceased individuals who were cognitively fine, but they had tons of plaques and tangles, enough to say it's Alzheimer's, that's not enough. You have to have inflammation in the brain as well. Mm-hmm. So you really need drugs to hit each stage of the disease. And the earlier in the pathway you hit, the earlier you have to give that drug to the patient to get results. And we haven't yet thought about the disease and treatment and that with that type of granularity yet. Mm-hmm. I think that's where we're going next.
Yeah, so it might not be one drug. It could be a cocktail of drugs like HIV patients receive?
It could be a cocktail, but you also have to give the right drug at the right time. If you have congestive heart failure, you don't just give somebody Lipitor and say, there you go. Mm. You know, you have to treat the heart. It's already late in the disease. Lipitor is meant to prevent heart disease. Same thing. We have various drugs that are being tried that hit the amyloid, which is a very early event in the disease. So you have to treat that either before the disease strikes or at the very early stages. If someone's already deep into the disease, you need to treat what's going on in that brain right now, which is also tangles and inflammation. So the cocktail has to also take into account where they are in the disease. And unfortunately, the trials that have failed so far have used drugs that have not been that good. Mm-hmm. Some of us wonder why they went as far as they did, mm-hmm. and they weren't given early enough. And those failures should not be interpreted to say beta amyloid is the wrong target, because everything else we've learned about this disease, especially from genetics, says that is the first target. Mm-hmm. But we need to take advantage of all the targets through the entire pathway, and genes, especially the genes we're finding through the Cure Alzheimer's Fund, Alzheimer's Genome Project, are leading the way in terms of telling us how to do that.
Right. We're talking with Dr. Rudy Tanzi, one of the world's leading Alzheimer's researchers. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to ask a question, here's your opportunity, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. You just mentioned the whole genome sequencing project, and that's one of the things your lab is working on. So can you talk about how the genes are related to Alzheimer's disease, what that entails?
Well, it's hard to find a case of Alzheimer's disease where genes are not involved, but in the vast majority of cases, it's genes plus lifestyle that affect your risk. The first genes I found and others found in the 80s and 90s were genes that have mutations that guarantee the disease, regardless of lifestyle, by about 50 years old, and those are very rare, maybe 1% of cases, but we've learned the most about the disease process from those genes. Mm-hmm. In most people, it's a variety of genes with different types of variations in them combined with lifestyle that determine risk. Those genes, as we elucidate them, and we have this Alzheimer's Genome Project that Cure Alzheimer's Fund, which is just an incredible foundation, just shows the power of when a group of people mm-hmm. who are devoted and passionate about a cause get together, what a difference they
right.
make, And they put together this Alzheimer's Genome Project that we directed, and we have found dozens of new genes. And now we have to learn how do those genes actually lead to disease, and that's why we need this whole genome sequencing. We actually go in and dissect those genes and find out exactly, what's going on in those genes that increase your risk for Alzheimer's. And in some cases, they protect you from Alzheimer's, and we have to figure out that whole gamut. Mm. And that's what guides drug discovery with the greatest certainty.
Yeah. You mentioned lifestyle, and as I'm going, let's hear, because I hadn't heard that before. What are some of the lifestyle risks?
We know what is good in lifestyle, and it's kind of a stretch to say if you don't do that, then it's a risk factor. But we know that, as with heart disease, physical exercise is very good for the brain. It helps grow new nerve cells. It helps clear the pathology. We know that a healthy diet, mm-hmm. The same type of diet that's good for the heart, is good for the brain, especially a Mediterranean diet. We know that listening to programs like this right now is actually helping to reduce risk, because growing new synapses, learning new information, intellectual stimulation is great for the brain, because the more connections, the more synapses you make in your brain, the more you can lose before you lose it, so to speak.
Yeah.
Staying socially engaged. It's not good to hole up in the house. You need to be social. The brain loves when you're with other people, and especially when you're helping other people in society. So those are the four biggies. Of course, there's also the idea that red wine can be protective, but that did come from the University of Bordeaux, so we're skeptical. Not that it stops us from having a good glass of red wine.
Right.
Exactly. Let's talk to Bob, who's giving us a call from Brewster. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Mindy. How are you?
Good.
I want to thank you and Sean for this great work. This is absolutely what we need to hear about.
Thanks, Bob.
I have a question as a child, an adult child of a person with Alzheimer's. I understand that there are studies available now that can give you fairly high indication of the potential for having Alzheimer's as second generation. I'm wondering, should we, those children of parents with Alzheimer's, should we take these tests? Are they accurate? What can they tell us? Mm-hmm. And what can we do once we learn that we are potentially likely to have Alzheimer's?
Okay, let me start with that. That's a great question. I think the answer from a scientist, a geneticist like myself, about how well we can predict Alzheimer's genetically is a little different than the companies that sell the kits. Mm. You know, in our mind, we know about, we have a handle on about half of the genes involved. And the other half of the genes, we know the genes, but we don't yet know what variations in those genes matter yet. So I would say that we're very good at predicting the very rare early onset form of the disease that strikes under 50. But for your garden variety Alzheimer's that strikes after 75 or 80, it's a work in progress. We don't have enough genetic information to do a reliable test. This does not stop many DNA testing companies from charging money to do a test that doesn't have a lot of value in my mind. Mm-hmm. There's one big gene predictor called APOE, which does predict risk, but it is not sufficient on its own to give you enough of an indication about whether you're on your way to the disease or not. Family history is really trumps all of it. I mean, it's really, you know, you need to look at family history, and that really will give you an idea of whether you need to be a little bit more vigilant, a little bit more diligent about keeping track about whether you're on the way. So how do you do that? So genetics gives you early prediction, but how do we do early detection? In other words, try to see where the disease is starting pre-symptomatically before there's any cognitive issues. And now there are imaging techniques in the works. There are in the cerebrospinal fluid, there are biomarkers that can be looked at that are actually getting to the point where they can predict if one's on their way to the disease 10, 15 years before. So if you have a family history and you're worried about it or you're having some issues cognitively, there are new ways evolving that's still not mainstream for looking at early detection. But in answer to your question, in terms of genetics, we don't have yet a completely reliable genetic test for anything other than the early onset form of the disease, despite what, you know, the Internet and what companies may say.
Yeah, Bob, thanks for the phone call. Dr. Tanzi, you mentioned early onset, and these folks are really key to unlocking some of the mystery here, right? I mean, they're very important to the studies.
Yeah, so the thing is, in biology, when you have a gene that carries a mutation, you know, a defect, which guarantees the disease, that's a very unfortunate gene for the families involved, of course, and our heart goes out to them.
Of course.
These are the ones we want to help the most. You know, it's just devastating to get this disease at 40 years old. But that type of gene, and we thank the families for working with us because we'd be nowhere without them, that type of gene is the best in terms of you can put it into a cell and you know it's going to do something wrong. You know it's going to show you some molecular, cellular event that's incorrect. And if you want to develop effective therapies, you have to know what to fix. You have to have something that's broken. These types of genes show you what's broken, and thus you know what to fix with the drug. So, for example, at Cure Alzheimer's Fund, we have different drug discovery programs in the pipeline in various stages of development that are based on what we learned from those early onset genes. Those are driving most of drug discovery today.
Mm. Yeah, some of the largest and expensive drug trials are either just underway or about to begin. What do these drugs do? How are they different from the previous efforts?
They're not that different, actually. It's funny because, you know, the drugs that failed were aimed at trying to clear the amyloid out of the brain or stop it from being produced. It's kind of like the kitchen sink overflowing with water, the brain overflowing with the amyloid. You want to turn off the spigot or unclog the drain. I still think that's the right idea, but unfortunately, the drugs that have been tried, I think, have been rushed into trials without enough information by various companies. And so these drugs, either they're not safe or they don't get into the brain, or they get into the brain and they're not potent enough. So I think we have the right goal, the right target, but unfortunately, most of the trials that are still in the, you know, in the multi $100 million stage that you read about in the papers are still doing more of the same, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And we hope for the best. For example, Lilly has an amyloid clearing type of therapy using antibodies. The trial failed, but they saw some benefit in the patients who were in the early stages. So they said, well, let's try it again with patients who are in the early stages and focus on them. And we hope for the best. But I would put my money on the smaller biotech companies who are bringing in the third wave of drugs, the ones that are under the radar, the ones that the Wall Street Journal and New York Times don't cover as much, that are being a little bit more clever about how to, you know, clear the amyloid and prevent it. And Cure Alzheimer's Fund is funding actually a couple of different efforts of these very clever drugs that get around some of the safety issues the previous ones have had to try to hit the amyloid. With that said, that's still not enough, may not be enough for a patient who's well into the disease. Because like I said, it's using Lipitor to treat congestive heart failure. You have to treat the disease itself. So we're also developing drugs that try to hit the inflammation. We've learned about a whole slew of genes from this Cure Alzheimer's Fund, Alzheimer's Genome Project, all these genes that trigger inflammation in the brain once you have Alzheimer's pathology. It turns out that when there's inflammation subsequent to the original pathology, that can kill more nerve cells in the brain than the original pathology. Mm. So that becomes a big target for those who already have this disease, and we're actively working, again, with Cure Alzheimer's Fund on developing those drugs as well.
Mildred is giving us a call from Provincetown. Hi, Mildred.
Hi. My husband was a professor of philosophy. He's 94 now and is in his 13th year since diagnosis. And he's very happy and cheerful and everything, but I really, you know, he has a hard time, articulating things during the day. But at night, I think he was teaching a class one night, talking in his sleep, and last night he remembered David, our next door neighbor, who to him is a total, you know, he doesn't remember him during the day. So, and the only conversations I can have with him anymore are in his sleep. Hmm. What is going on?
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
That's a first for me, I have to say. I guess that, you know, I mean, the thing is, when you sleep, you're accessing your memories in the brain in different ways. Remember that, you know, when you have a memory, it's always by association. Something happens that triggers a memory, which then triggers another memory. And in Alzheimer's, to trigger those memories, usually it's using a pathway in the brain that starts to break down with the pathology. So it's possible that during sleep, because other pathways are being turned on and other ones turned off, you know, that maybe he's recalling certain memories through a different pathway in the brain, and then in some extraordinary way is able to verbalize that. So that's very interesting. And does it happen often?
Yes, all the time. I try to encourage him as I say yes, you know, and he'll go on, and it's such a fascinating thing to me that I can have this previous person at that time, but not during the day.
Yeah.
Wow. I think it just shows us more about the mysteries of the brain, how the brain can compensate and find its way to blocked memories through pathways that are just, seems to me, turned on at night that are not turned on during the day. And certainly the brain is a different type of organ at night when you're going through slow-wave sleep. You know, during slow-wave sleep, the deepest sleep, you actually consolidate memories. Mm-hmm. During REM, of course, you're having dreams. And it'd be interesting to know whether he's doing this when he's in REM or slow-wave sleep. I guess, do you know what time, how long he's been sleeping when that something like this happens?
No, I really, you know, I think it varies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but I couldn't tell you because I don't, you know, look at the clock or anything. I'm just encouraging him to say something more.
Yeah, of course.
He's probably in REM, and is somehow able to verbalize, and somehow in the dream state he's able to access memories that are blocked during the day. So yeah. It's fascinating.
Mildred, thanks for calling. You know, that kind of reminds me of the one of the nursing homes here. There's a musician who goes in and she plays different, you know, tunes. Mm-hmm. And some of the more advanced folks with Alzheimer's actually, who don't communicate, will sing along some, you know, memory they must have had from, you know, from earlier. I thought that was fascinating when I heard that.
Music is a powerful tool. In fact, I'm working with some folks to develop an app for the iPhone for caregivers and family members, where we are going to customize set lists of music to the patient depending on where they were born, when they were born. You know, people form their musical taste between about 13 and 25 years old. Mm-hmm. And when you can stimulate not only with music, but with music from their day that were really... they really meant something to them in their teens, for example, once you turn on one part of the brain, it starts to fire up other parts of the brain. And so you can get a lot of new brain activity and even, you know, help exercise the brain and get extra cognitive abilities by just stimulating with music. And I think it's a very powerful tool. Mm-hmm. And so we're very seriously working on that.
Dr. Tansey, one of the researchers I spoke with said something to me, and I want to get your reaction to it. He said, don't think that we can't, through science, recover memories. He said people who live with someone with Alzheimer's know this, that some days they're really bad and some days they're really good and they remember things that they couldn't remember on the bad days. So that, to him, was an indication that just because they can't remember something now, maybe through science that could change. What do you think about recovering memories?
Absolutely. I think the call we just had about sleep, you know, it's not like the memories are gone. Mm-hmm. It's access to the memories, and there are many different ways to remember something. The night of your senior year prom in high school, there could be the smell of a certain flower. There could be a certain song that plays. There can be many different cues from your sensory system that can trigger a memory. So that memory can be there, but it could be that all the pathways trying to get back to that memory, especially a sensory cue, and that's what gets blocked in Alzheimer's, is sensory to short-term cues, that they're blocked. But then we heard a great example of someone in their sleep where they're now some other pathway's been turned on that's allowing you to get to a memory that's there, but it's just finding the way there in the brain. So I would totally agree with that idea.
Yeah. We're talking about Alzheimer's research with Sean Corcoran, our senior reporter and editor. His series, Desperate for a Cure, The Search for New Alzheimer's Therapies, airing all this week. And Dr. Rudy Tansey, one of the world's leading Alzheimer's researchers. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Bill is calling from Orleans. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. Thank you very much for a great show. As the adult child of a mother who fought the disease for at least 15 years, and I was actively involved in helping with her care, I've seen what it can do. And I was wondering if Dr. Tansey could speak a little more about the inflammation aspect of it, in part because people, including myself, deal with inflammation in other parts of the body and wonder what the connection might be, and if there's any research or advice on if that aspect can be dealt with, where the other beta amyloid issue and the tau seem to be longer term aspects.
Yeah, so from what we've learned from the genetics, amyloid seems to come first. This triggers the tangles, nerve cells die, and then both the amyloid and the dying nerve cells trigger inflammation. Inflammation in the brain is a very old method of the brain to protect itself. And see, so that when the brain sees dying nerve cells, it assumes there's an infection, meningitis or encephalitis. And so these other cells in the brain called the glial cells, that are normally housekeeping and nurturing and they're helping the nerve cells, they put on their battle gear and try to protect the nerve cells, and they start to shoot out free radicals. They think they're killing some foreign invader because they see all this nerve cell death. They see this amyloid, they don't, you know, and they're trying to help. In the end, it's collateral damage. It's friendly fire from these free radicals that kill more nerve cells. In fact, in the end, probably more nerve cells than the original amyloid plaques and tangles. So the inflammation process in the brain is very, very specific. It involves very specific molecules and genes. So to try to, you know, target that with drug discovery, we have to do it in a very intelligent way. Early on, we thought maybe we could just use ibuprofen or COX-2 inhibitors, you know, the way we treat inflammation in the body. But those treatments didn't do so well. So we need to be much smarter about it. So basically, this is a work in progress. We have to understand exactly how the inflammation is turned on, which genes and proteins, receptors are involved, and develop those drugs. And Cure Alzheimer's Fund has a whole program just dedicated toward developing those types of drugs that's ongoing right now.
Yeah. Bill, thanks for the phone call.
Great.
One of the things, you mentioned that about the inflammation, going back to those when we talked about not risk factors but benefits, that Mediterranean diet, that's a diet that is sort of anti-inflammatory, right? I mean, anti-inflammation.
Yeah.
So some of these, and exercise, those are all things that deal with inflammation as well.
Sure. So exercise, you know, also one of the best ways we know of to get new nerve cells born in the brain, specifically in what's called the hippocampus. That's the short-term memory area that gets affected in Alzheimer's. And growing new nerve cells in that area can be very helpful. But exercise does it, probably better than anything we know, even better than, you know, drugs that are meant to induce new nerve cell growth. The Mediterranean diet is more of an antioxidant diet, and it is meant to minimize free radical damage. It says less red meat. It says, you know, more grains, nuts, fibers, things that are good for the heart. Mm. I mean, if you follow the rule of whatever is good for your heart, it's going to be good for your brain.
Yeah. I want to go back to the drug companies for a minute. What do you see from drug companies these days? Are they invested in Alzheimer's? And we hear reports that pharmaceutical companies are pulling out of research, in frustration, I guess.
Well, some are pulling out out of frustration. Some are still digging in. I think it's, you know, right now, with the failures that we've seen, and again, I blame those failures on the therapies that we used, not on the target. I think that, again, the genetics tells us the beta amyloid is the right target for the early part, you know, if you want to prevent the disease or hit it early. But I think there's a lot of activity in biotech. You know, we're seeing another new boom of biotech interest in coming up with more innovative drugs that, you know, once they have some positive results in the early trials, phase one, phase two, the pharma can come in and grab those, you know, for the larger, more expensive trials, which is what pharma does well. So I am not pessimistic. I was actually more pessimistic when the other trials were ongoing, and many of us just didn't feel they had a lot of promise because they weren't the best therapies. So I think it's almost like when the Red Sox had to bomb out, you know, last year, and then clean themselves up and say, okay, now let's start over again, and now, you know, we're in the playoffs. I think Alzheimer's has gone through a similar type of road, that we've cleared out a lot of stuff that didn't work, and now we're seeing a lot of activity with more innovative approaches to the same target, and I remain optimistic.
Dr. Tansey, we were talking earlier about sequestration and the 5% reduction in NIH funding that has resulted in terms of research.
It's more than 5%, 18%.
18% now, okay.
Yeah.
What do you expect now that with the government shutdown? My understanding is new studies can't go forward. What's the thinking among the researchers like yourself?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's hard enough to get a grant these days, and because, you know, the percentage of grants to get funded is quite low. But what people also need to know is once you get your grant, first is an administrative cut. So let's say you asked for, you know, $250,000, there'll be maybe 5 or 10% right off the top because they're adjusting for how much money is available. And then because of sequestration, there's another 18% on top of that. So if you ask for $250,000 to do a project, you're probably going to get, if you're successful in the greatest way, you're probably going to get $190,000. In terms of the cost. And so the next thing you know, you don't have enough to do your project, and you have to start cutting back, and you don't have enough people. So It's a big trouble in funding in every way, getting the grants and then these cuts from sequestration to cut down the money. This is why we're so grateful, for example, for the foundations to come in and help ameliorate that, like Cure Alzheimer's Fund, who gives us. I mean, to get a grant these days, you have to have so much data. You have to almost have done most of the grant project before you get the money to continue it, and this is why you need the seed money to generate lots of data these days to have the best chance to get the grant. So foundations like Cure Alzheimer's Fund are kicking in and allowing us to do that.
Yeah.
We'll get through, but we would not be able to get through without the private sector and foundations stepping in to help.
Yeah, in the last couple of minutes, let's talk a little bit about this Cure Alzheimer's Fund, because you head up the group's research consortium. So how does that work, and what's the goal?
Well, the Research Consortium is some of the best and most proven, brightest Alzheimer's researchers in the world. As a group, we not only collaborate and we're funded to do projects from the Cure Alzheimer's Fund, we have regular phone calls, we're emailing every day. It's basically, because of the Cure Alzheimer's Fund, all these silos are broken down, where now many of the top people in the field are talking to each other or emailing every day on collaborative projects, because part of the Cure Alzheimer's Fund way of doing things is to fund folks to do new and innovative things, take chances where the federal government might not fund you, and make sure you talk to each other, share the information, and try to work together. And it's been a spectacular success. When I look at the papers and studies that have been published with Cure Alzheimer's Fund support, it's amazing. They're in the top journals in the land, the highest impact journals, New England Journal of Medicine, Nature, Cell Science. So the bang for the buck is beyond what I ever thought it could be when the Cure Alzheimer's Fund first started. So I think there's something to getting really bright people together, make sure that they talk to each other, and make sure that they seek out the best projects, the best people in a timely manner to make sure that you get the greatest bang for your buck, make sure it goes to the best. And this is very different than just having grant submissions come in willy-nilly,
right,
hoping for the best, and then just funding a bell curve.
You're seeking out the best.
That's what they
do. Yeah. Dr. Rudy Tanzi, the Joseph and Rose Kennedy Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School and the Director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at Mass General Hospital. Thank you so much, Dr. Tanzi, for taking time to talk with us this morning. We really appreciate that.
Well, thank you for having me. The time flew by.
I know, right? And Sean Corcoran, our senior reporter and editor, his series Desperate for a Cure, The Search for New Alzheimer's Therapies, airing all this week in Morning Edition at 7:30 and again at 4:50 in the afternoon during All Things Considered. Thanks, Sean.
You're welcome, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.